The presidential election season is unprecedented in a lot of ways. The rules, as we've heard so many times, just don't seem to apply this year. Not for the candidates, not for a lot of the voters out there, not for pollsters or prognosticators, but what about reporters, the human beings out there telling us what's happening on the campaign trail? They get lumped together as the media. But their individual backgrounds may help shape the news they deliver in ways we can't even imagine. I'm Gina Kaufman for KCUR's Central Standard, and Sarah McCammon has been covering the Trump campaign for NPR. So if your radio is tuned to this station, you've almost definitely heard her voice. She's a Kansas City native, and today we'll hear not just her voice, but her story. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Gina.
Thanks for joining us. You're in a hotel in Nevada, I believe?
Yes, as you probably know, this is a really important battleground state. It was blue last time, has been for a while, but the Trump campaign is hoping to turn it red, and there are some important races up and down the ticket. So I'm doing some reporting, getting a little bit off the trail for this week, although I did go to a Trump rally here yesterday, and talking to voters. So
off the trail.
Favorite thing to do.
Can you explain what you mean by getting off the trail?
The campaign trail. Normally, my job most of the time has been really since Trump clinched the nomination and even as he was getting closer to it to follow Trump around. That would be the majority of my job. So sometimes on a press charter, which is a plane that's chartered by the campaign, paid for by the media. All the reporters from the networks and the major papers and wire services get on this plane. It allows you to basically get from place to place quickly. And then other times we just fly commercial, kind of depending on our needs in a given week. But regardless, I'm spending a lot of time going to Trump rallies. And sometimes you're just in and out very quickly. And so sometimes we try to stop and take a minute and get off of that sort of mad rush and get out and talk to voters. And so that's what I'm doing this week, spending several days in the Reno area, which is sort of the battleground of battlegrounds in this state.
As you get off the trail, have you met anyone? I mean, specifically since you've arrived in Reno, have you met anyone who surprised you?
Not so much. I feel like I'm hearing the same themes from voters over and over again around the country. And since I cover Donald Trump, I have spent a little time crossing over. Tamara Keith, White House correspondent who covers Hillary Clinton, and I have switched a little bit just to kind of get fresh eyes and see what's happening on the other side of the world, as it sometimes feels. But I'm in a position mostly to talk about Trump voters and Donald Trump. So if you hear me talking a lot about him, that is why I'm focusing on him. That's what I cover.
Yeah.
A lot of the big themes that I've heard all over the country are really the same. For people that are attracted to Donald Trump as a candidate, they are, they're very frustrated with the system. They feel that the establishment, whether it's the media or the political system, Washington, D.C. certainly is set up to benefit themselves and not to benefit average Americans. They feel left behind. They feel a lot of them have a lot of racial and demographic anxiety. Most of these are white voters who feel like in their minds, there's a lot of immigration, Latino immigration from, refugees from the Middle East. They feel threatened economically and sometimes in terms of safety by that, they tell me. And they see Donald Trump as someone who is strong and will call things like they are, will say things that they're afraid to say, and someone that they tell me gives them a lot of hope, which I know if you talk to folks on the other side of this election, it's completely the opposite. But that is what Trump supporters tell me.
When did you start covering the Trump campaign?
So I came up through the member station system. I worked at member stations a lot, like KCUR. I moved away from Kansas City for college, so unfortunately I never got to work for KCUR, but I love your station. It's a great station, good people there.
Go on.
And I have worked... Sorry, they didn't pay me to say this, but I'm a huge fan of KCUR, I have to say. So, and it's really cool to be talking to you. But so I worked in Nebraska, Iowa, and Georgia Public Broadcasting before coming to NPR. So I got hired out of that system, came in last summer, like a year ago. One of the very first people I covered during the primary season was Donald Trump. I was just leaving Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Trump was... coming through South Carolina, you know, nearby. And I was supposed to be off that week, but Trump had just made the comments in Iowa that everybody probably remembers, calling John McCain not a war hero because he'd been captured. And so I hadn't even officially started at NPR, but the desk reached out to me and said, can you go cover Trump in South Carolina? Do you mind hopping over there? So I did. And I have to say, at the time, I didn't expect a lot. I mean, you know, Trump, no one did. I expected this was sort of, you know, just sort of a lark, right? That, you know, Donald Trump's running for president. He's not a typical candidate. This probably won't go very far. And I have to say, even then, in I guess it was July, I was really amazed at the energy for him. I was really surprised by veterans there with Veterans for Trump signs and the energy against him. There were protesters, many of them immigrants' rights protesters, just a handful. It wasn't the big protest you see, you know, you saw later in the cycle. But that very first day really kind of opened my eyes to, like, oh, this is not going to be a typical campaign. And that was also the day that, you might remember, he gave out Lindsey Graham's cell phone number to a national audience, because Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, you know, the state he was in, had been critical of him and his comments about McCain. From there, though, I covered a lot of Republican candidates throughout the primary. You know, I rotated around and then really started focusing more on the top few, Trump, Rubio, Cruz, I would say in late winter, early spring.
With the Trump campaign, I mean, and coverage of it, on the one hand, you have people out there saying that reporters aren't doing Trump justice. I mean, perhaps of those people, none so vehemently as Trump himself. And on the other hand, you have people saying, or at least you did for a really long time, don't even say his name. Don't give him any attention. What is it like to be caught in the middle of those cultural currents?
That's one of the hardest things about this job, because no one is happy, it seems like. But I have to say, I think we have tried to apply the same journalistic principles to covering Trump as we would to covering anyone else. You know, those principles being, you know, you're looking at a lot of factors, especially during the primary, to decide who to give coverage. You know, resume comes into it, right? If you know anything about politics, usually resume matters. So, you know, we covered Trump at the beginning, but we didn't cover him, I don't think, nearly to the same degree that a lot of, you know, we certainly didn't run his rallies like a lot of the TV networks did. We covered, you know, all the major Republican candidates, and Democrat as well, but I covered the Republican race. So again, that's what I'm talking about here. I spent a lot of time with Ben Carson, with Carly Fiorina, with Ted Cruz, with Marco Rubio, some time with Jeb Bush. You know, we tried to cover everybody because, you know, I really think to serve our audience, they need a chance to get to know everybody that has, like, you know, a snowball's chance of being the nominee. And then as it became clear from the polling and from primary results that Trump was, you know, a real candidate and had a real shot, we did, you know, begin to cover him more. And that included covering his controversial statements and, you know, always trying to bring analysis and fact checking to that. You know, we've done many, many, many fact checks over the course of this election cycle. And we do see that as part of a big part of our job.
I want to talk to you about that. Oh, sorry. Go on.
I mean, but you're right. You know, I hear, you know, especially on Twitter, and we hear constantly from people who think we cover him too much, or people who think we cover him the wrong way, people who say I'll get called in sometimes in moments apart an apologist for Trump and, you know, and a shill for Hillary Clinton. So you can't please everyone. But again, as a journalist, we bring the same principles to covering any candidate, which is try to present what's going on in context, what's new, what does it mean, is it accurate, and then the bigger picture of what's happening in the country, you know, what are the trends, what are voters thinking, and what's driving all of this.
You've said that your conservative Christian background growing up here in Kansas City has helped you connect with people on the campaign trail. Can you explain that?
Right. This is something that, you know, I didn't used to talk a lot about because really I think ultimately it shouldn't matter, you know, whether however you grow up, who you are, your identity shouldn't matter too much. And again, the same journalistic principles apply. And yet at the same time, I think something we value at NPR is a range of perspectives and life experiences, because that does inform, you know, ultimately a lot of what we're doing is interacting with other humans, and your own human experience informs how you do that, the questions that you ask, the way you relate to people. And one of the very cool things about the team that I'm on at NPR Politics is we have a really big range of class, race, religion, sexuality, just everything is represented there. And I don't think it was by design so much as our editor put together just a really good team and looked all over the place, looked at member stations, looked throughout the organization to pull a team together that had the right skill set. And it also happens to be a really, you know, diverse group of people. And we have fascinating conversations, many of which you can hear on the NPR Politics podcast, which is kind of a place where some of that is allowed to play out. But from my own background, excuse me. Yes, I grew up conservative Christian in Kansas City, Missouri. Went to a Christian school. We were evangelical, but we didn't really identify that way. We just kind of used the word Christian, you know. And I was my parents were very engaged in politics and from a, you know, conservative perspective. So
how were they engaged?
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk a ton about my parents. It's their life, not mine. But, you know, they were involved in some activism. And I was and it was just always sort of a topic of conversation. You know, my dad would watch the political shows every single Sunday. Well, he'd tape them and we'd go to church and then we'd watch them after church. And I loved that. You know, it was fascinating to me. And we'd go to victory parties on election nights to you know, cheer on. You can imagine, you know, my parents are Republicans, so it was Republican candidates. But, you know, it was and I think, you know, as I got older, I became more interested in, you know, not taking sides and being a journalist and sort of talking about the questions rather than promoting specific answers or solutions.
Why do you think that is? What do you think it is about you that veered toward not taking a side, but in just delving into underlying questions? Especially growing up, you know, enmeshed in a more activist family.
I think because, you know, those questions are complicated. And I also know a lot of people. I mean, I also had people in my life growing up who felt completely the opposite of what my parents felt. And so I knew that there were other perspectives out there. And yeah, I mean, I think some of it's just the way I'm wired. I can't really tell you why, but to me, the things that we fight about, whether it's religion or politics, you know, as a society, I mean, just look at our country right now, right? We have a lot of division and we have a lot of angst and fear on both sides. And it's more than both sides, because there are third parties and there are a lot of people who are voting for the major party candidates reluctantly.
And they're totally so disenfranchised people who just aren't even connecting.
Yeah. So point being, these are difficult questions. You know, how do we live together? What's important? What do we value? Who gets resources? What is right? What is wrong? Those are actually, I think, pretty difficult questions sometimes when you get down to the nitty gritty. And you can see that because you see well-meaning people who disagree about a lot of things. And I saw that in my family and I saw that in my community. And to me, like, those intersections and those clashes are just fascinating. I like to know what people, how they process those questions and how they come to an answer and how they decide which side they're on or what view to take, and how they regard people who are different. Because I think in a democracy and in a pluralistic democracy like ours, we really have to wrestle with that. We have to figure out, how do we be who we are, be true to who we are, and also live together? Otherwise, you know, without that, we have chaos.
When you approach people wrestling with those questions, whether they are aware that they're wrestling with those questions or not, I mean, you said earlier that who you are shapes those human interactions that allow you to get the stories as a journalist. So what is it, how do you think your background, the background you just described, shapes the way that you draw that out of people, draw out of them how they're wrestling with these really profound questions right now?
I think some of it is just an understanding of the context from which they come. You know, I don't think it's any secret that, and again, since I'm covering Trump supporters, I'm going to talk about a sort of how they're viewed. I don't think it's any secret that a lot of liberal-minded people are totally mystified by the Trump phenomenon. And people I know who are of that persuasion often ask me, what is going on? What is this about? Why on earth would anyone vote for Trump? Well, people who are supporting Donald Trump often have the very same sets of questions about Hillary Clinton. And I don't want to get into, false equivalencies here, but I'm just saying, in terms of the experience of people in this election, that is what it's like. So when I'm talking to people who, don't live in DC or LA or New York, who maybe are blue collar, maybe are not, certainly not all Trump supporters are, but probably have ties to more working class environments than, the typical sort of DC beltway institutions would. When I'm talking to them, and also people, many of these people have very deep religious beliefs, I feel like I know where they're coming from. And so, for example, yesterday I had two separate conversations with Trump supporters where they just spontaneously brought up their faith, their Christian faith. And as it happened, they were from a sort of charismatic Pentecostal. Both of these people were charismatic Pentecostal backgrounds. A couple of them talked with me in detail about the way they felt like, coming to faith had changed their lives and some of the experiences that they'd had. And I know that for people who haven't had those experiences or been close to people who have, sometimes that kind of talk is uncomfortable and foreign and strange, but it's not to me. And so I can engage with people, I can listen to them and kind of speak their language. And I think that creates a trust and an openness and sometimes, allows me to build from there. I want to hear about other things that, are also sometimes personal and emotional things, like how you view your community, how you view this election. I think for a lot of people is a pretty intense emotional thing.
Absolutely. I want to hear some examples of exactly what we're talking about. And I'm going to start actually not with coverage of the Trump campaign.
Are you still there? I'm not hearing you.
Oh, do you hear me now? Well, we're going to hear some tape from Sarah McCammon's coverage, not of the Trump campaign to start. We're going to actually back up and hear a little bit of an older story about refugees. It came out in 2015. It's about what the Bible has to say about our response to the Syrian refugee crisis. And we'll hear a little bit about what inspired the story when we reestablish our connection with Sarah. But for now, let's go ahead and listen to Sarah responding to a man who says we shouldn't put ourselves at risk trying to help others. In this case, obviously, refugees.
So I asked him, what about the fact that many refugees are fleeing terrorism themselves? He responded with a parable from the Bible about a farmer whose enemy sabotages his crops by planting a type of weeds called tares amongst the wheat. The trouble, he says, is that you can't tell right away which is which.
Amongst them is the tares. The tares are in with the wheat. We have to figure out how to get the tares out of the wheat.
So we're going to have...
No, I was talking and then all of a sudden it went quiet.
Yes. Sarah, are you back?
I don't know if I'm back. Am I back?
You're back.
Oh, good. Okay, yay.
I'm going to tell you what our listeners just heard. Our listeners just heard a clip from your 2015 coverage of people's response to the refugee crisis. They heard you asking a gentleman how his view that we shouldn't put ourselves at risk trying to help others, how that corresponded with his Christian faith, and he told you a parable. And I was wondering how your own background might have helped you tell this story, because you got not just his point of view, but a lot of different Christians explaining how they viewed the relationship between the Bible and the refugee crisis.
Right. And I don't know if you, I'm not sure at what point that we dropped out there, but did you hear me talking with Trump supporters about their faith just yesterday here in Nevada?
Yes.
Okay. So that this is kind of in the same vein, really. It's another example of where, I'm having a conversation with people, and for deeply religious people, the Bible is just part of their language. It's sort of the air they breathe. It shapes all of their decisions, or at least that's the goal. And so for that gentleman in Iowa, this was around the time that there was a lot of talk about Muslim immigration and Syrian refugees, and there continues to be.
And, you know, I was hearing from, there were really mixed views within evangelicalism about how to respond to that, which is another thing that I think is really important. Sometimes I think national media has a tendency to lump people into groups and, you know, this group feels this way and this group feels this way. But really with evangelicals this election cycle, there's been a lot of different points of view and opinions about Trump and about the Syrian refugee issue. There was a major evangelical group that came out and said, look, it's part of our religious, our Christian obligation to help people who are in danger. Jesus was a refugee. We must help these people. And that was, you know, quite in contrast to what Donald Trump was saying, you know, even at a time when many evangelicals were coming around to supporting him. Certainly, though, there are other evangelicals who looked at it differently. And this man that we just heard from was quoting the Bible. It was a parable about wheat and tares were, I think, weeds, kind of undesirable crops. And the whole idea of it was, you know, you have to separate them. You can't let it all get mixed up together because the tares could threaten your wheat crop. And the analogy that he was making from that was that, you know, we can't let in people that we feel might endanger us. So it's really fascinating to me how you get, you know, a group of people that believe, at least on paper, pretty much the same things about theology and, you know, salvation and the afterlife and Jesus and all of that, and then and also believe the same Bible, and yet can look at that same Bible and that same faith and come out with very different responses to a specific moral conundrum.
And it seems like parables, I mean, in a way, that is a form of speaking the same language, what you were describing earlier, that you can speak people's language and that helps you report on them. You mentioned how your coverage of the Trump campaign kind of parallels this. You get a lot of perspectives in your reporting from voters, and you have an uncanny ability to hear people out and even help them sort out their own views. I want our listeners to hear you interacting with a woman who explains her allegiance to Trump this way.
He could shoot someone on Broadway and I would still vote for him.
You don't really mean he could shoot someone and you'd still vote for him?
Well, only if he just wounded him. We'll just let him wound him.
So I can imagine that a lot of reporters would not have tried to help that person clarify her remarks the way you did. I mean, she said something fairly shocking, which there are some mentalities around journalism where that would be just gold by itself. But you tried to help her figure out what it was she was saying. What is it you were able to glean about her support and maybe other Trump supporters from that interaction?
You're right. Outrageous statements like that are often journalistic gold because they get people's attention. And, you know, on the one hand, words do matter. And I think when people say things, we should take them at face value. At the same time, when I talk to people who are mystified by the Trump phenomenon, they often ask me these questions like, well, you know, Trump supporters say these things. They say he's going to make America great again. They say he's a great businessman. And, you know, do you ever push them on that? Do you ever push them on what they say? Like, do you ever dig into that? And I feel like that is part of my job, is to dig a little deeper beyond just the sort of quick answer people give. Because, you know, everybody sometimes talks in hyperbole, especially, you know, this woman was, just about to retire hospice cook. That was her career, cooking for people who were dying and their families. And, you know, if you met her at the grocery store, you'd think she was a super nice lady. I was pretty sure she didn't really mean that she would be okay with shooting somebody. And I wanted to press her on that. Not to apologize for what she said, but just to really probe, like, okay, did you hear what you just said? Do you mean that? and I think, to me, that's more revelatory than just repeating out of any kind of context, a sort of extreme statement. Now, you can, you know, I do think that politicians should be held to different standards than voters when it comes to that. But when it comes to voters, they, you know, these are the people who are making the decision about ultimately about who's going to be our next president. And I want to know what they're really thinking.
She was, I would say, like, more honest with you than a lot of voters might be, even with themselves. She came around to saying something to the effect of that she was just trying to express how loyal she was, you know. And I'm curious how you get someone to open up with you in that way. I mean, maybe you just kind of got at it, that you know she's this hospice cook, that you took the time to know her enough.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the thing that I wish sometimes. I wish that liberals could come along with me and talk to Trump supporters at length. I wish that conservatives could come along to a Hillary rally and talk to Hillary supporters at length. I'm not saying nobody ever talks across the aisle, because they do. But I think sometimes between our siloed media environment, our tendency to scream at each other on social media where there's no eye contact, there is no real human connection, we lose the fact that, however different we may be in some ways, there are some things we have in common, and we're all human. And I think that empathy is powerful, and you have to get to know somebody a little bit to begin to understand where they're at. And I hope that leads to something more constructive in the future. I don't know.
Sarah McCammon with us from NPR. Stay with me through the break. We'll hear what it's like to be on the campaign trail this season, and we'll learn a little more about what guides Sarah's approach to her coverage when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. We've been talking with Sarah McCammon, a Kansas City native who reports on the Trump campaign, and she brings us sound like this.
Now this is a crowd. There are thousands of people outside that can't get in. Fantastic. Way to go. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
So what you don't often think about is that there is a person standing in that crowd you hear, Sarah McCammon in this case, taking you to this place. Sarah, describe to me what it is like for you to be immersed in that crowd we just heard.
I think the thing that would surprise people who never would be seen at a Trump rally is the amount of energy and excitement. I was in the ladies' room yesterday here in Reno ahead of a rally, and women were talking to each other, and they were just so excited. One woman said, "Oh, it's so great to be around people who are on the same page. I can finally come out of the closet," was the term she used.
What is her closet exactly?
I think it's the thing that, again, the thing that people tell me a lot is they feel like Trump is saying things they can't say, whether that's good or bad for the country, for the discourse, is a whole separate matter. But these folks feel like Trump is saying things that about immigration often, about other countries, about terrorism, that they don't feel like they can say out loud without being socially ostracized. And so I think they come into these rallies and there's a feeling of being sort of unleashed. And there is, a lot of excitement. The music is extremely loud. You heard that God Bless the USA. The thing that I found when I'm traveling on my own is I try to get to rallies really early and talk to people sometimes outside, because the music is often so loud that it's nearly impossible to talk to people inside. And it's pop music. It's quite a range. There's Rolling Stones, Elton John, I think some Pavarotti. And from what I understand, it's just music that Donald Trump really likes. And it seems sort of designed to get people hyped up, excited, good vibes, kind of.
Yeah.
And, so people are in a really good mood. They're really excited to see Donald Trump. Most of them have been watching him on TV for months and have never seen him before in person. You know, that's something I always have to remind myself. I've been to dozens probably of Trump rallies, but most people have never been to one at all. And so this is a big, big day for them.
We heard Trump doing something there, talking about the size of the crowd. You've called out Trump for claiming that reporters never show the size of crowds at his rallies. But when Trump criticizes the media in general, do you think there's any validity in his critiques? Because he does that a lot.
He does it a lot. And he has stepped it up and intensified it in the months that I've been covering him. When it started out, it was, the media, and politicians often criticize their media coverage. Bernie Sanders criticized his press coverage. Ted Cruz had a line in his stump speech that he'd throw out most of the time about how when he became president, all kinds of reporters and journalists and editors were going to check themselves into rehab. It would always get a good laugh from the crowd. So, making the media the pit of or the butt of the joke is and the target of criticism is a common tactic for politicians. And yet with Trump, it seems different in degree and in tone. It's become disgusting reporters, bad people. Those people are the enemy, he said this week, I think in Vegas, while my colleague Scott Detrow was there. Is it valid? It's not my job to sort of evaluate the entire media as a whole. I would just point out again that on the other side of the aisle, people say the media hasn't been hard enough on Trump and has enabled him. And Trump says the media is completely unfair to him. And I'd also point out that while Trump continually criticizes and really, I think, undermines the press, his people, anytime, you know, CNN or another news organization put out a story critical of Hillary Clinton or put out a poll that looks good for him, they're quick to send it out. So they obviously have some acceptance of the media.
Yeah. Sarah, I'm so sorry that we have to get out now. And I hope that we get to talk again sometime. Hopefully we can follow up and hear more of your story. Sarah McCammon of NPR News, thank you. And we'll be following your coverage.
Thank you so much.
When we get back, a mysterious shape in the Missouri landscape. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Central Standard will be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. When you fly in and out of Kansas City, do you like to look down on the metro and see what it looks like from above? Looking at the whole city from that vantage point can make you notice something you wouldn't notice otherwise. On the latest edition of KCUR's new podcast, Question Quest, our friends Suzanne and Cody take us to find out the meaning behind a shape in the outskirts of Kansas City that you can only see from the sky.
From KCUR Studios, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Cody Newell.
And this is Question Quest.
We're setting out to find landmarks,
oddities,
legends,
all the curious things in the Midwest that make you wonder, what's up with that?
We'll put them in two decks of cards, shuffle them up,
and take turns each week sending each other on a quest to find out the answer.
Okay, Suzanne, so you're about to embark on your second quest. Pick a card.
Okay.
What? The Belton Octagon.
Nearly 3,000 feet across, this octagonal plot of land outside of Belton, Missouri, is the source of a lot of internet speculation. What is going on in this octagon?
What? I've never heard of this.
So I had never heard of this until very recently, and I don't know very much about it at all.
Okay. How did you hear about it?
Through Reddit, which is the most magical place for mysteries. People were saying that it was either a crop circle, some place where UFOs had set down. Other people had suggested that maybe there was some sort of like either industrial or like military stuff going on there at some point.
Okay, cool. I'm really excited for this one because it's weird.
It is weird. It's very strange.
And it's very mysterious.
I love science fiction, so already my mind is spinning with ideas about this octagon. But I try not to get too Fox Mulder from the get-go, and I reel myself in. Really, there's probably a reasonable and simple explanation for all of this.
Of course. You've got a little bit of Mulder and Scully in you. I think everybody has a little bit of that.
I look at the Google Maps image of the octagon and start to think about the last time I was on a plane, and what the ground looks like from above. The roads, circles, and squares of the landscape, how they look like a giant quilt covering the earth. And it got me thinking, a lot of people make things that are intended to be viewed from this perspective.
Just count numbers of rows and stuff so you get the size of it right.
Gene Hansen has counted a lot of bean rows to spell out different messages or make designs.
I do fly. I have my own home-built airplane. And I thought, well, I'm going to go up and see what this thing looks like. And I'll be darned. I was really surprised myself how well it turned out.
He's referring to his most popular piece, the one he did that made international news. Once upon a time, the land was in a plenty. After Prince died, he plowed the iconic Prince symbol into his field.
Rest in peace.
Just little old Gene Hansen in Edgeley, North Dakota, you know, doing something out in the field just to play around with, and all of a sudden here you're known all over the world, basically, just from that little symbol.
Obviously, a message like Happy Mother's Day or GOP Get Your Act Together project a clear message and meaning. Those are some other things that Gene has plowed into his beanfields. And the print symbol means something to you when you see it. But what do other symbols and shapes mean when you see them? What could an eight-sided polygon near a small town in Missouri possibly mean? So, Cody, are you very good at math?
I can hang, I think.
What was your best subject in school?
Probably English.
Okay, so we're going to do a little bit of geometry.
Oh, God. Ooh, is that a, what is that, a compass?
You got a protractor?
I do.
And a compass and some graph paper.
Okay.
So finding meanings and how geometric shapes are used in art, architecture, and nature is called sacred geometry. And it can get into some pretty bizarre and mystical realms. But I want you to follow Professor Paul Coulter's instructions. He has more of a mathematical approach. He's written a lot about this stuff.
You have a pencil and paper in front of you?
I do have a piece of paper and a pencil.
Okay, draw a square.
And you all listening at home can do this too, even if you don't have a compass or all the fancy tools that I got Cody.
Like how big? How many boxes?
It can be as many boxes as you want. Just draw a square.
Got it.
All right.
And draw the two diagonals, corner to corner.
Okay.
So basically you should have a square with an X going through it that marks the center, right?
I do.
Put the point on one corner, and then open it up so that the pencil tip goes through the center.
Okay.
So it's open to half the diagonal. And with that setting, swing an arc all the way from one side to another.
All right. I got it, I think.
And where the arc cuts those sides, make a dot.
So wait, are we going all the way?
Sure, you can. Okay. But really the point is about that point right there where your pencil is crossing over to join the square. There you go. Now do that again from every corner.
Oh, from every corner.
So you wind up with eight dots. You with me?
Yes.
Okay.
Connect the eight dots and you'll get a perfect octagon.
I did it. Yay.
This construction is called a sacred cut construction.
And also if you swing that compass all the way around, you have essentially four larger circles at each corner of the square.
Wow. All right. Yeah, that was cool.
So Professor Paul Coulter says a Danish engineer, Thomas Bruns, was the person who called this construction the sacred cut construction. And that's because it contains both squares and circles. The sacred cut unites what is believed to be the earthly and divine.
The square usually represents the earthly because of the square corners mimicking the way we build buildings and lay out roads. Everything is square and orthogonal. The circle is often used to represent heaven or the infinite or the irrational, continuous, without end, no corners.
Paul says that the sacred cut construction is seen in a lot of ancient art and architecture. And he says there are also practical reasons why octagons could have been used a lot in these constructions, because it was an easy way to ensure proportions without having to do calculations. All you would need is a straight edge and a compass, and you could just drive pegs in and swing arcs. So if somebody made the belt an octagon shape on purpose, what do you think they'd be trying to say, Cody?
There are a lot of people nowadays who seem real into like the Illuminati conspiracy kind of thing, and that's like sort of the vibe that I was getting, at least from the subreddit, of people being like, I don't know what's up with this, but it's this crazy octagon and it's out in the middle of nowhere and it could be just all these crazy things. Like that was the vibe that I got. Or I was actually kind of hoping that like the person that was there that made it was like this weirdo who's real into that stuff.
So I was thinking maybe the person who made this octagon in Belton had all these sacred geometry ideas in mind, and maybe they were a philosopher, an architect, mathematician, or maybe even just a quilter. So the octagon is about 184 acres, and it's surrounded by a square of roads. And just north of the octagon, there's what looks like a runway, you know, for airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take the Google Maps setting off where you see the trees and terrain, like just have it in the map form, there's an airplane symbol near the octagon, and it says Robinson. So I call the number listed next to it, and an elderly man answers who's really hard of hearing. And he tells me I should just drive out to the property and meet him.
So we are entering Belton, Missouri.
The Octagon is a little bit of a ways south of town, and I pass by a lot of farms. And at this point, Cody, I'm thinking this guy on the phone is probably an old pilot. He's probably into art and shapes, and he just wanted to do something different with his field. End of story. But that is not what ends up happening.
Well, what happened?
Well, I got there, and I was right. He was an old pilot. But he didn't want to be recorded or go on the record with anything. I hung out with him and his family for many hours, and they took me to see the perimeter of the Octagon, which is all fenced off. But all you can see on the other side of the fence is trees, and you can only access the Octagon by going through their private property. But yeah, they didn't want to talk on tape. But what they do confirm is who owns the Octagon.
And that is...
the United States government.
I knew it! Illuminati, chemtrails, everything! No.
So they are not big fans of having the Octagon as their neighbor, but that's as much as I can really say. Also, I hear from other neighbors who also don't want to be identified that there's frequent helicopter traffic in and out of the Octagon.
What?
So we leave the area with still no real answers.
Yeah, I don't know. My head is kind of swimming right now. It's really hot outside. I'm really hungry. Stuck behind a garbage truck.
I stop on Old Main Street in the town of Belton, and I go to Terrace Cafe and Malt Shop to refuel.
That is a really good limeade.
Then I walk down the street and meet up with Rob and Pam Powell from the Belton Historical Society.
Do y'all know about an octagon?
Pam asks some of the museum volunteers about the Belton Octagon, but they have no idea. She also doesn't know anything about it, but she does know a lot about the history of Belton.
I can find a quick map of town.
She pulls out a book that was put together for the town's centennial back in 1972.
If you look at this symbol for the centennial.
And Cody, I want you to see this logo.
Let's see it.
So it's a circle, and at the top it says Belton, Missouri, and then inside the circle there's a square, but it's shifted 45 degrees to the side, and it represents how the town is laid out. And I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. But on the left, there's a drawing of a train, and it says Proud Past. And then on the right side, there are two airplanes, and it says Bright Future.
The train is why Belton's here. And because the track really is, just a straight line through town, they made their town not a square, but more like a diamond. So, and people love to say, there is no way to find north in town.
So basically, the town's streets are set up like a grid surrounded by a square of main roads, but it's all offset to the side, the train tracks kind of marking the center. And I'll admit, for a small town, I got surprisingly lost a few times. So the streets don't go north and south. It's like if you go up North Main Street, you're actually going northwest.
Okay, so everything's just shifted a little bit, huh?
Is that rare?
Not in Belton. It's the reason there's a lot of traffic accidents, too. The people come out here and they want to turn left, so they're doing a 210-degree turn from here to here.
Yeah, that's not a turn you usually want to make.
It's really interesting to think that this town from above also has its own unique geometry. And I wonder if it has anything to do with the Octagon. But the Powells don't know anything about that. They say when Belton was founded with these diagonal streets, farming and the railroad were the big things. But in the 1950s, when Richard Skibauer Air Force Base opened, it changed everything.
Everybody was looking at the sky because all of a sudden there were jets in the air. And that was the beginning of the Richard Skibauer Air Force Base.
And that really changed the town. It brought in a lot more people to the area. And Rob says his school basically doubled in size. I talked to some other old Air Force guys about this place, and they tell me the base, which was around for almost 40 years, kind of had a funny nickname. They called it Dickie Goober.
That's a silly name.
But yeah, it eventually closed in 1994. So the Belton Octagon is about 10 miles away from where the Richard Skibauer base was, but I think that they're probably connected in some way. I put in information requests to the United States Army, the Air Force, the EPA, the Air Force Historical Agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Reserves.
Man, I feel kind of bad that you had to call those people.
It can be difficult to identify the correct agency sometimes with these things, but I find out that the Octagon was originally part of the Air Force Base, even though it is a few miles away from it. But when the Air Force Base closed in 1994, it got reassigned to be used as a military training area. As more and more people got back to me, and after navigating through a complicated web, I eventually found the person who could tell me what the Octagon was being used for back in the day and what was happening with it now.
Belton was just an old Air Force site, the radar communication area that they disposed of and gave to the Army Reserves.
This is Michael Bryant. He tells me the Octagon area was used as an off-site radar and radio station for Richard Schabauer. And he says that was pretty common for these stations to be put 10 miles away from like an actual runway. Michael is the director of plans for the training for the 88th Regional Support Command.
The Army is kind of a noisy thing at times.
Michael is in charge of 14 local training areas, Belton being one of them. And he says they're used as training areas for reserve soldiers on the weekends. At the Belton site, there are 500 people, civilian soldiers, in the area that can use it as a place for training.
So practice convoy operations go on there. It's a big flat area, so the units can go out there and do field training exercises.
He says they're not firing weapons or storing ammunition. They do things like sling load trainings, which involve using helicopters, and they do simulated trainings about how to deal with IEDs, which are used as roadside bombs. Michael says that they do these things so that they'll be prepared.
If heaven forbid, something happened to the KC area, like a terrorist attack or something like that, you know, FEMA would come in, kind of like the hurricanes that are going on now. Well, they'll need a staging area. And if they need support from the Army Reserve, those troops are there to help them. And the staging area could be the Belton local training area.
And all of this stuff is really fascinating and not at all what I was expecting.
Not what I was expecting either.
But there's still that burning question. Why is it in the shape of an octagon?
Right.
The stop sign, that's what we call it.
Michael says he's been asked that question so many times. And he says none of the other training areas are that shape.
What?
And he's tried to find out the answer.
So never, ever got the answer, and I looked for that, why it's in that shape, but it's kind of unique.
But I can't let it rest. So I ask Paul Coulter, our sacred geometry expert, and I tell him everything I learned about how it was used by the Air Force as an off-site radar station, and then how it changed hands, and how it's now used as a local training area.
I'm racking my brain here, Susan, but I can't think of any reason why it was somebody just chose this shape.
Maybe someone just chose a shape. Man, I would have thought there'd be some reason, like some advantage to that.
Maybe. I just could not find the answer.
I'm still fulfilled, though. You went through so much work, and I'm glad that we know what's going on.
So I didn't fail my quest?
No, not a failure at all.
Okay, good. Thanks, Cody. That means a lot to me.
I'm sure it does.
So we end this episode with some trivia.
I'm getting it this time.
A polygon with 8 sides is called an octagon, and a polygon with 16 sides, double that, is called a hexadecagon. What do you call a polygon with 1,000 sides? A, a myriagon? B, a chiliagon? C, an icosagon? D, a didiagon? So a myriagon, a chiliagon, an icosagon, or a didiagon? Which one has 1,000 sides?
I'm going with D, didiagon.
No, I made that up. And all the other answers are actual shapes. So a myriagon has 10,000 sides. A chiliagon, the correct answer, has 1,000 sides. And an icosagon has 20.
Ugh, man. Never going to get any of these right. That was a hard one.
That's all right, Cody. I also still am proud of you.
All right, that's it. Thanks for listening to Question Quest. If you have some ideas for places you want us to explore, send us an email. It's questionquest@kcur.org. Get in touch with us, and we'll put your ideas into our decks. You can find me on Twitter. I'm @CodyNewell, and our show is @QQ_podcast. Music this week is by Prince, Cyrus, Diva93, and Suzanne. Our producers are Sylvia Maria Gross and Brianna O'Higgins. I'm Cody Newell, and you're Suzanne Hogan.
Yep.
Tune in next week.
That was KCUR's new podcast, Question Quest. We're airing it Thursdays here on Central Standard. You can subscribe to Question Quest, or to a podcast of our show for that matter, on iTunes, Google Play, or whatever you use to get your podcasts. If you missed our conversation with NPR's Sarah McCammon earlier in the show, you can catch it at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it ready for you later today. Tomorrow, our Screen Time series explores Idiocracy. The movie made a decade ago is now a cultural touchstone, shorthand for the dumbing down of everything from media to politics, television to sports. But are there messages in the movie we didn't notice? That's tomorrow. In the meantime, if you want to talk to us, connect on Twitter. We're @KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. We had help today from Amy Jeffries. Raven Brooks is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.